Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll cut through the noise with interviews, insight, and straight answers from people who make the decisions. Coming up. The South African Reserve Bank moves to reshape the country's cash system. Alphabet, Amazon and Meta on track to control 58% of global ad spend. A cannabis industry blueprint is promising a reset for South Africa's weed economy. And Madam and Eve celebrates 30 years of lampooning the country. It's Thursday, the 18th of December. Now, you might have seen the Reserve Bank is looking at a major shakeup of South Africa's cash system. And here's the interesting part. It would include a proposal for shared ATMs across all banks. Now, as I understand it, the idea is to cut costs, improve access, and make cash infrastructure more efficient at a time when cash usage is declining, but obviously still essential for millions of South Africans. But a single ATM network, I think, raises big questions around competition, around fees, around security, and perhaps even who has ultimate control over access to cash. In that respect, we're going to talk now to honorary professor at Wits Business School and economist at Altitude Wealth, Professor Yanni Rousseau. It's always good to talk to you, and thank you so much indeed. What's your assessment here? Why do you think the Reserve Bank is pushing for a shared ATM system, and why right now?
Jeremy, looking at this matter from the Reserve Bank's perspective, the one element is, of course, cost. The other element is reduction of risk. Cash is a risky business. We know that in South Africa. So the Reserve Bank will not only focus on containing costs, but will also focus on containing risk. And in respect of a single ATM system, it implies less cash movement through South Africa to serve a single ATM system rather than each institution serving its own ATMs. So from that perspective, from the risk reduction perspective, the single system will make sense. At the same time, the switching costs between different ATM systems will disappear where people do not have access to the ATMs of their own banks. However, it reduces competition, and it also introduces the risk of the single ATM system falling over and not working on a particular point in time.
How, Professor, do you think the banks are going to respond then to this proposal?
The Reserve Bank is the type of institution that would have discussed a proposal of this nature with the banks before making a public announcement. So my sense would be that the banks in principle might have agreed to this proposal, or else the Reserve Bank would not have made the public announcement. The banks would also look from their side at risk and cost. It might reduce their risk and it might reduce their costs.
What type of costs do you think could be reduced? Would they be substantial?
Well, number one, the switching costs between using different ATM systems of different banks would be a cost reduction to the public. That would, of course, be an income reduction to the banks. And at the same time, the risks would be reduced, which is a difficult cost to estimate, but banks would be interested in reducing the risk and cost of moving cash. So all in all, this might lead to a cheaper system, but there would be a few losers like the security industry, etc. When we talk about cost savings, it will generally be the public that benefits, and some of the service providers will have less income.
Professor, you mentioned the possibility of a reduction in competition between the banks. Explain that to me, and how would that occur?
Well, banks compete with one another in terms of placing their ATMs, and making their ATMs available to the public, and they try to find a competitive advantage in the locations of their ATMs. And if we have, as the Reserve Bank call it, brand neutral ATMs, that competitive advantage of certain banks will disappear.
And Professor, who do you think would own and control a one ATM for all banks model?
The Reserve Bank has in mind a public utility type of company with various shareholders, admittedly, but the utility type of company would control the ATMs. The related matter, of course, is that the use of cash in the economy might be on a decline. In recent years, the demand for cash grew at a much lower rate than before. And if the growth rate of cash falls away, if we see negative growth in cash, the Reserve Bank will, of course, lose its seniorage on cash in circulation. So the Reserve Bank's profitability might also come under pressure if the system leads to a reduction in the total cash holding in the economy.
But inevitably, this is a stepping stone either towards a cash light or even a cashless economy. That is inevitable, isn't it?
I would not use the word inevitable in my lifetime, Jeremy. I remember when I was young, about 40 or 50 years ago, when I studied at university, we had to write papers on a cashless society and how that would work. 50 years later, we still have cash with us. So clearly, cash is being phased out of the economy. But in my view, we are far from a cashless society. But yes, as we develop better electronic instruments, the demand for cash will decline.
So we have a single model that's being proposed. Professor, to the best of your knowledge, is there international precedent for this kind of system, or are we an outlier here?
I've seen references to the system used in the Netherlands. I have not studied the system used in that country, but I have seen some remarks that we will replicate a system used in the Netherlands. I've just seen the Dutch reference, but I don't know to what extent it will replicate, how comparable it will be. I've not done such a system, such a comparison, for the simple reason that very little on our system had been published to date. It is an announcement of discussions by the Reserve Bank that will follow next year.
You mentioned switching costs. Ultimately, what would happen to ATM fees? Do you think in a system like this, they would go up or down?
They would definitely go down. I mean, if the fees go up, it makes no sense. Then rather just keep what we have. So my expectation is lower fees. If the net effect is higher fees, there's just no reason to do this.
And Professor, what might this mean for rural and township access to cash? As I said at the start of our conversation, millions of South Africans are still cash dependent.
The expectation is that it would make cash easier and more accessible in outlying areas of the country. Again, if it does not achieve that objective, there's no reason to embark on this journey. Then rather just keep what we have.
Thank you very much indeed. It will be so interesting to see what emerges on this particular front in coming months. I've been in conversation with Professor Yanni Rousseau, honorary professor at the Wits Business School and also economist at Altitude Wealth. Yanni, thank you very much indeed. Appreciate the time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Global advertising is booming again, on track to hit $1.19 trillion US dollars this year, but the growth is increasingly concentrated in just three hands. New data from the World Advertising Research Council shows Alphabet, Amazon, and Meta already control more than 56% of global ad spend. For markets like South Africa, it obviously raises hard questions about media sustainability, pricing power, data control, and whether local publishers and advertisers can still compete in a world dominated by a closed digital ecosystem. Well, let's explore some of that thinking. I'm talking to Alex Brownsell, now head of content at Wark Media. Alex, a very warm welcome to you. This is so interesting. Advertising growing faster than the real economy in real terms. It almost seems that this has fully detached itself from economic reality.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair to say, and we've seen a lot of new sources of money moving into the advertising market. We think that's one of the key drivers here. So, for instance, cross-border e-commerce, this is a relatively new thing that we are seeing. You know, particularly exporters in regions like China selling into North America and Western markets. We're also seeing a lot more investment from smaller businesses, SMEs, who previously had spent on advertising and marketing, but it was much more fragmented. It was, you know, classifieds, that kind of thing. And it tended not to live within this world of measured media. But also the larger advertisers and brands themselves are moving budgets that were sort of previously, you know, referred to as things like trade marketing or sales, where they would perhaps spend with a particular retailer, and that is now becoming part of the measured media world, and that's having the effect of really, you know, putting sort of the wind in the sails of the advertising market.
Three companies, as I mentioned, controlling nearly 60% of spend. It might sound efficient, but it is also dangerously concentrated.
Yeah, it certainly feels as though we are reaching a point where the media market is potentially not functioning properly, and that competitive element. We understand why I think a lot of brands are looking to do this. These platforms play host to a lot of the influencers and creators that are perceived as being particularly important when you're trying to reach younger audiences. They have been incredibly shrewd at building the kind of AI-driven self-serve tools that offer that sort of perceived ease of use, that perceived point of, you know, sort of closeness with the point of purchase. But we don't believe that pooling all of your eggs into a single basket or a couple of baskets is necessarily the most effective way to achieve your goals.
And it does raise questions, doesn't it? If all incremental growth is going to big tech, it has a real impact on smaller local media ecosystems. And for a market like South Africa, it does raise serious concern.
Yeah, there's no getting away from the fact that local media players are under pressure to try to find a way to, if not necessarily grow market share, but then certainly to defend what market share they have and the spend they do receive from advertisers. South Africa's market is relatively, you know, in a healthy position. We you know, we've seen that the TV spend, for instance, has held up relatively well compared to what we've seen in other markets globally. But there is no doubt that an increasing share of spend is going to the Metas, the Alphabets as well. So it's a case for local media owners and media sellers to try to find ways that they can attract advertisers with not necessarily the same level of sophistication of tools, but that they, you know, they are seen to be as easy to fit into a media plan as the big tech companies are, and it's a challenge.
Alex, I read as well that retail media and so-called bottom of the funnel channels are surging. Does that mean that brands are sacrificing long-term equity, do you think, for shorter term measurability?
Yeah, we think so, regrettably. It's something that we've written about extensively. We have seen this short-termism is rife in the market, and you know, with good reason. Consumer spending is under pressure, which means often the advertising budgets are under pressure. And we've seen a survey that we recently conducted with the global marketing community found that 42% of those that we surveyed believe that their marketing budgets going into 2026 will be reduced. Now, that's a 20 percentage point increase on what we saw 12 months ago. So what spend is being continually allocated, what budgets are there, are under so much pressure to return that investment as quickly as possible to justify the expenditure. This is a real challenge for marketers, and we think it draws them towards short-term solutions at the detriment of the long-term health of the business. Because if you're not topping up that future demand, you are ultimately entering what we sort of refer to as a performance doom loop. where the results become weaker and weaker and weaker until you're having to spend huge amounts on performance marketing just to achieve what you were doing for a much smaller expenditure 6 months ago or 12 months ago.
And compounding the problem, you say that display advertising on the open web is shrinking, and that is very self-evident. Do you think the open internet is slowly being hollowed out?
I think so, realistically. There are still going to be opportunities outside of the major walled gardens, you know, the Metas, the Alphabets, the Amazons, for instance. However, what we are seeing is that the way that inverted commas traditional media is trying to fight back against those big tech players is to almost create walled gardens themselves. So that could be joining forces with other TV broadcasters. You know, we're looking at consolidation, particularly in the TV market at the moment, where TV companies are trying to sort of produce their own sort of walled garden environments with customer data, with tools and AI kind of in enhancements as well. The ability of an advertiser to just sort of hop between websites as they did in the open web days really does feel under pressure.
And something which is a conversation in itself, but there's no doubt that artificial intelligence, Alex, is lowering creative and agency costs. But who's actually, do you think, capturing the value here? Is it brands or platforms?
The platforms, I would say almost certainly. I think there is something to be celebrated in the sort of democratization of creative tools, particularly for smaller advertisers that haven't necessarily been able to, you know, create that sort of quality of asset previously. But I think for brands, and we are in the foothills of this trend of seeing AI generated advertising released into the market. I think there is a risk to the ability of a brand to create distinctiveness and to create something that really resonates, because as we know, AI tools fundamentally work by learning from what exists already, not necessarily by creating something new. It's for the agencies, this is obviously a huge challenge, and that's why we've seen so much disruption, that we're seeing so many agencies coming and going, and convergence and M&A activity. You know, in my time, 20 years in the industry, I've never seen anything like the last 12 months. And we're probably going to see more of this kind of disruption as agencies learn to play in this new ecosystem.
And let's wait and see what 2026 brings. Alex Brownsill, thank you very much indeed, from the World Advertising Research Council, Head of Content. I do appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, it would seem that South Africa's cannabis sector is stuck in something of a legal grey zone at the moment, caught between constitutional rights, stalled commercialization, and ongoing police harassment, I read, of legacy growers. Now, a coalition of industry players says it has a practical way forward. Project Indlela claims to offer a workable blueprint, it says, to fix regulatory confusion, protect consumers, and bring legacy communities into the legal economy. So is this the breakthrough that the cannabis industry has been waiting for, or just another policy proposal that is heading for the filing cabinet? I'm in conversation now with Albertus van Jaarsveld from the South African Cannabis Club Alliance. Albertus, a very warm welcome to you. What exactly is broken then in the cannabis framework right now? What's the problem here?
When it comes to our current state of legislation, the problem is that it is still based on outdated prohibition era laws. When you look at South Africa's cannabis framework, we've got a rich history and heritage with the plant, especially with our indigenous communities such as the Bantu, the Khoisan, and the Rastafarian, which have close ties with this plant. Now, at the moment in South Africa, since 2018, it is legal to possess and cultivate cannabis in private, but it still remains a criminal offense to sell. The only way that you can legally obtain a license is for medicinal export purposes. Now, this creates a massive barrier to entry for our indigenous growers, and it by default excludes them from the economy. The reason for this being is because they simply don't have the resources or the finances to obtain the licensing and set up the massive facilities which is required to meet the heavy GMP standards. So at the moment, we are still treating cannabis as Schedule 6 pharmaceutical, which is completely unnecessary and creates a lot of barriers to entry.
And tell me, Albertus, so, is there any sense that this is going to change in the short term, do you think?
Not in the short term. Everything is a process and it takes time. But what's a big sign of hope for us is, you know, it's been now 7 years since the Prince judgment, and everything has been like kind of stuck in limbo. Whereas now, it's with our movement of SACA, we push to unite and lobby the cannabis sector, especially through cannabis social clubs. And with that, we convened webinars where we invited stakeholders across the industry, as well as government officials. Now, the government officials that were present gave us a clear indication that they're going to do more than listen. They're going to take our input into consideration for implementation in the upcoming regulations. And that is a massive sign of hope, you know, because for the first time, government is indicating that they are open to build a regulatory framework that meets the needs of the people.
I'm sure that you're taking some encouragement from this, but to me that sounds like a very vague promise. The reality is that cannabis needs to be descheduled to unlock real economic participation. And the problem, Albertus, is you still don't have a time frame, do you?
And look, we don't have a time frame. When we talk about a time frame, what we do know is that the Cannabis for Private Purposes Act has not been promulgated yet. Government officials gave us indication that in March 2026, they aim to put out the commercial framework for public input. And, you know, this could take anything between 2 to 3 years. As you say, that is the problem. There is no set time frame on this. And whilst that is happening, our people in the townships are still being arrested. There's no clear regulations for law enforcement on how to deal with cannabis. And, you know, all we've got is the Drugs and Drug Trafficking Act, which clearly states that selling cannabis is still illegal.
And tell me, Albertus, to what extent then is industry-led self-regulation working?
Well, if you look across South Africa, there's hundreds to thousands of outlets all that have emerged, you know, in this gray zone where there's a lack of regulations, where people have how can I say, there's various degrees of models and, you know, ranging from very ethical to non-ethical. You get the private club sector, which is based on the Cannabis for Private Purposes Act, where, you know, people exercise those rights in a collective, because not everyone has the means or the abilities to grow their own. So they come together in communities and they set up non-profit stock fells or community collectives where they can cultivate the plant together. And that, according to our understanding, is still constitutionally sound. And then you've also got all the more commercial outlets like the Section 21s.
Yeah.
It's actually all false, because you need a doctor's prescription to use this medicine for research purposes. And basically none of the clubs or dispensaries do that. So what's happening is, you know, we are flooding the market and taking it away from the people that have carried the plant for us, the custodians, are indigenous heritage growers.
All right, Albertus van Jaarsveld, unfortunately, I'm out of time on this discussion, but it's an issue that we'll be following with a great deal of interest in 2026. Albertus van Jaarsveld from the South African Cannabis Club Alliance, I do appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
After more than three decades, the iconic Madam and Eve strip remains a sharp, affectionate mirror of a country often in chaos. It's powered by Stephen Francis's writing and Rico's unmistakable illustrations. And this year's annual, available in all good bookshops, I guess, it's called Madam and Eve, Madam Impossible, poses, though, I think, a bigger question. Why does this cartoon strip still work, and what does it really take to keep it fresh and relevant and contemporary? Stephen Francis, a very warm welcome to you. And did you ever think that this work of yours would have such enduring appeal so many years later?
Absolutely. From the very beginning, we not at all. It was kind of an accident. We didn't expect it to go anywhere. People said, oh, you can't do a comic strip about this. So we gave it a shot. And thankfully, the Weekly Mail at the time immediately loved it and put it in. Then things just started to snowball. And now here we are decades later, which makes me feel very old. But yeah, we're still here doing it, and we have, I got to say, we have great material. That's the secret. We have great material. So I'd like to thank the government for providing that comedic material. Thank you very much. They've been doing it for a long time, and of course, other governments, like the one in America. You can't, some of these things just write themselves.
It's outlived, Stephen, governments. It's outlived presidents. It's also outlived scandals. Why do you think this quirky relationship between two individuals remains so enduring?
Because I'd have to say because it's well written and well drawn. But other than that, I think it's because people can relate to it. You know, there's a lot of things that are universal. So, you know, we have a lot of readers overseas. But I don't know. It's just people have always said, you know, Mother Anderson, the go-go in the strip. They go, oh, that's my neighbor, or that's my own grandma, or I know someone who drinks gin and tonics all day, just like she does. And so I think it's very relatable, and hopefully it's funny. We have great. We have the Hadidas, and we have this year we have a lot of new characters, which are great.
Let's talk about new characters in just a moment, but I'm interested in the principal characters, Stephen. The relationship between Madam and Eve, how has that relationship evolved over the years as South Africa itself has changed?
Well, yes, they've definitely evolved. In the beginning, there was a lot more edge, although we like to keep the edge still going, but it's a lot more gentle these days. I mean, it was at the time... Eve was definitely a big underdog, and what people who didn't get the strip in the beginning didn't understand, she actually is the hero. She gets over on Madam all the time. But we used to do things like she was on the would sleep on the ironing board, and we don't do that anymore. And we are looking to maybe change Eve a little bit and bring her into more modern times. Maybe we're thinking of Eve starting her own podcast and takes off. So she can afford a house next door to Madam, and so they become neighbors. But we got to keep the conflict up. That's the important thing, I think. It's good comedy or drama always depends on conflict.
Do you think it's harder as the writer to satirize politics now, given that real life that we're living in, both in this country and in the United States of America, as you mentioned, often just feels like a cartoon anyway?
Yeah, it is. I mean, people say you can't write this stuff, but actually we do. But I mean, as I said before, it's just the government provides a lot of material, and just life around here provides a lot of material. You know, I spend time in America and I spend time in South Africa, and I'm here for the holidays. And on my way back from the airport, our driver, who we use all the time, we've been using him for decades, he likes to send me little tips or ideas. And he mentioned that they're cleaning up the streets for the G20. And I thought, oh, that's great. So we kind of had fun with that. Then we just did a cartoon a few weeks ago after the G20 was over. And suddenly they go, okay, you know, open up the potholes. Okay, turn the water back off. And, you know, take all the broken continue the broken robots and all the stuff that they... All the cosmetic changes they did to impress the G20 guys on the way from the airport. So,
And Stephen Francis, G20 aside, when you look back at 2025, was there one national moment that you knew had to make it into the strip this year?
Well, yeah, the thing that we've evolved also with Madam and Eve is, you know, we started with the basic characters. But, you know, we're big fans of Doonesbury. In fact, I met Gary Trudeau. Big, big moment for me. And we use kind of his style. But so we have different characters that have nothing to do with Madame and Eve. We try to get them in the strip as much as possible. But we, I say one moment, especially since I was born in America, in New York, is Donald Trump. And when he, the whole thing with the tariffs, and when he assigned tariffs, he's talking about tariffs for Antarctica, when it's mostly ice and snow. We thought that, everyone thought that was funny. So we created a character called Pete the Penguin Diplomat. Mm. And he goes to see Donald Trump to try to negotiate a better tariff deal. And of course, they get into it. And Donald Trump threatens him, you know, I'm going to have ISA on you. And Pete the Penguin goes, I'm a penguin. I love ice. And then they challenge each other to a game of golf. And we have quite a few cartoons about that. And we did the same thing. He goes to see Cyril to try to coach him on how to deal with Donald Trump when he goes to see him in the White House. And it's all in the book. It's all in this book, Madame Impossible.
Well, let's hope it's another 30 years. As you say, Madame and Eve, Madame Impossible. It is written by Stephen Francis, illustrated by Rico. And Stephen, congratulations on 30 years and good talking to you again. And that's where we are going to leave it for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.